Welcome to the Daily Bolster. Each day, we welcome transformational executives to share their real-world experiences and practical advice about scaling yourself, your team, and your business.
Welcome to the Daily Bolster. I'm Matt Blumberg, co-founder and CEO of Bolster, and I'm here today with Seth Godin. Seth probably needs no introduction, but I'll make a short one anyway, which is that Seth Godin is one of the top business thought leaders of our generation. He's written over 20 books. He has a great blog. He has the Akimbo podcast. He has TED Talks. He has a page a day calendar, which is up in my kitchen and probably should be up in yours or on your desk. Lots of other formats. Seth, great to see you. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, Matt. I also have a dog, Murray, who's right here.
Oh, so Murray, yes.
If he barks, you'll have to forgive him.
I've been excited about having you on this sort of Friday deeper dive podcast because, you know, a lot of people know you by your writings and by your thought leadership. But I know a ton of CEOs that don't actually know you. And that's why I like these Friday episodes. So I'd love to start with the simple question of how'd you get your professional start? What happened before the books?
Well, so I hesitate to go into this usually because for most audiences, what people are looking for is a point of differentiation to let themselves off the hook, right? That we hear about Steve Jobs' tortured relationship with his absent dad. Oh, well, if only that had happened to me, then I could have started Apple Computer, whatever it is. But the people who are listening to this podcast are already on a roll. So I'm just going to go ahead and indulge everyone's ego and explain. I got my start as a professional in a canoe 16 feet long in Algonquin Park, Canada, north of Toronto. I became a canoeing instructor in 1977 at the age of 17. I've taught thousands of people how to paddle a canoe. And in that moment of being face to face, a foot and a half away from someone who is dancing with fear, I decided I wanted to be a teacher. And I've been a teacher ever since. I've had so many lucky breaks along the way, including winning the parent lottery and the birthday lottery. But my first ostensibly professional job was working for David Cease and Bill Bowman at Spinnaker Software, where I launched at the age of 23, a line of science fiction adventure games. We invented illustrated text adventure games. I worked with Ray Bradbury and Michael Crichton and Arthur C. Clarke. And the people at Spinnaker, there were only 30 of us, went on to run some of the coolest brands in the world. I don't know what was in the water, but some very amazing things happened at Spinnaker.
Hey, you're right. A lot of it is the lottery, starting with the parent lottery and the birthday lottery for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the companies that you've started and led over the years. I know there's Yo-Yo Dine, which is where you and I first met. There was Squidoo. I know you're working on a new one. I'm not sure if you're ready to talk about that yet or not. That will have launched by the time this airs.
Yeah.
And I don't know if there are any other ones.
There are dozens, almost all of which failed. There was the door-to-door light bulb selling service as fundraisers for bands. There was the select guide to law firms in which the top law firms paid money to be in a directory. There was my book proposal for how to hypnotize your friends and get them to act like chickens. I wrote the very first book about emojis called The Smiley Dictionary. I did the Information Please Business Almanac, which was the internet in a 700-page volume. I'm the person who brought the Stanley Kaplan test prep books to the world. That took me 7 years. I have done projects for a really long time. Yo-Yo Dine was one of the first internet companies. We invented email marketing. You can blame me. And Squidoo was one of the first
Without you, there was no return path.
So there you go. So you can thank me. I'm still waiting for my royalty checks. And Squidoo was one of the first social networks. But GoodBids, which is launching in 2024, is something that's very close to my heart. We're trying to enable charities to raise $1 billion by replacing charity auctions with something generative and fascinating. And it's at goodbids.org if you want to check it out. The magic for me of projects is projects have a beginning, they have a middle, and they have an end. And if you're not prepared for it to have an end, you shouldn't embrace the fact that it has a beginning. And, you know, with Squidoo, we were the 40th biggest website in the United States. We had 8 employees. We had hundreds of thousands of paid users, some of whom were making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And in one day, Google turned us off. We went from being the 40th biggest website to the 40 millionth biggest website with no warning, no explanation, and no apology after the fact. And after 3 months of doing every single thing I could to fix it, I realized that I was depriving people of a better day tomorrow working on something else. And the team looked at each other and we found someone who was in a similar business and we offered them our assets and we went on. Because I could still be running Squidoo to this day, proving I was right. But it stopped being a good project because a bully wanted us to go away.
That is, there's such great wisdom in there for founders and entrepreneurs who frequently think, yeah, this has to go forever. Well, what was the end of Yo-Yo.Done? I forget, it got acquired by Yahoo?
Yes. What happened was, it's a juicy VC story, so I'll tell a short version of it. We were Fred Wilson and Jerry Colonna's first investment as a partnership.
By the way, we were their last one.
There you go, bookends. And they were funded by SoftBank. We were offered to be acquired by Excite because they were already in the online direct marketing business. And we accepted the offer because the funding environment in those days was very tricky for that 6 month window. And it would have taken me 20 years to make up for what Excite was going to offer us in the moment. And someone on our board violated their fiduciary duty and told Yahoo that Excite, their archenemy, was about to acquire us. Excite had a board meeting to pro forma just vote for the thing, and they were having a bad day, so they decided not to acquire us. They went back on their term sheet. So now I'm in really big trouble because my whole company has been turned upside down by knowing we're going to sell it and then we're not going to sell it. And I get a call the next day from Yahoo and they're like, hey, we haven't talked in a while. Are you around? And I said, funny, I'm going to be in San Francisco for lunch tomorrow. You want me to stop by? And then I like raced to the airport, bought a plane ticket,
you got on a plane,
flew to San Francisco for lunch. They didn't know that Excite had said no. And I wasn't supposed to know that they knew that Excite had made an offer. So I just sat quietly and they offered us a deal. And I was like, this is going to be the hardest thing I ever did. And it was professionally because it was like ripping my family apart. But I said yes and went to Yahoo. There were only 5 VPs at the time. And within 2 months, they had shut down every single one of our product lines. And some of the key people I brought with me stayed for years and years and years. Michael Landau went on to start Drybar. Jerry Sharshevsky went off to make quite a ruckus. So on the surface, it was exactly the right thing to do. But as I said, part of starting a company is it's going to end. And it almost never ends exactly the way you hope.
Who was the Yahoo CEO? Was it still Jerry or was it Terry?
No, Terry hadn't arrived. Terry arrived just as I was leaving. It was Jerry and Tim.
And Tim, I forgot about Tim. Yeah.
And so we got there. And meanwhile, they then bought Broadcast.com for more than 100 times what they paid for my company, even though we were profitable and Cuban wasn't. That was my fault for being profitable. But I realized I could just invent these businesses that they were plugging into Yahoo way cheaper than Yahoo was buying them after they'd been invented. So I said, hey, Jerry, here's what I want to do. Cut my salary by 90%. Give me just 2 people. We'll go to a cheap office across the street and we will bring you a business plan every 3 to 4 weeks that plugs right into what you're doing. And he turned to me and he said, Seth, that's a great idea. But if you did that, everyone else would want to do it too. So no. Like, that's the worst reason I ever heard. But there you go.
Let's move on to your I don't even know how to respond to that. Let's move on to your books.
Okay.
What of all the books, what's the best selling one in terms of numbers? Permission Marketing first or one of the other ones?
I think it's probably Purple Cow.
Purple Cow is my second guess. Yeah.
Followed by Linchpin and This Is Marketing.
Okay.
But what makes a book sell is different than what makes a book influential. And I have never organized my writing around how do I chop down as many trees as possible mm-hmm. and sell as many copies as I can. Because we know how to do that. And to my publisher's dismay, I don't want to.
So you just answered my second question. Okay. So I'll get to that. My first one was, which is the best selling? And my second question was, which has been the most influential or which is the one that you love the most?
Well, those are totally different things. I think there is no doubt that permission marketing was the most influential in the sense that it created a $40 billion a year industry that wasn't there before I wrote that book. That's if you're just going to measure a simple metric, you don't get to do that very often with a book.
Yeah.
In terms of which turned an industry inside out, Purple Cow, and then This Is Marketing sort of redefined marketing in a post-TV era. And I'm still pinch myself when I think about that. I mean, published it myself in a milk cart. It was a little cottage project when I began it. The ones I'm most proud of are Linchpin and What to Do When It's Your Turn.
I haven't read What to Do When It's Your Turn.
Oh, well, I will
give a sentence about each of those or a couple sentences about each. Linchpin.
Well, I don't see it here. Linchpin says 15 years before AI, what are you going to do when you've made yourself the cog of all cogs in a system that doesn't need humans to be a cog? What are you going to do when once we specify your job, we can find someone cheaper than you to do it? That the mindset of do what you're told and you'll get an A is over. And this was one of the first books that put a peg in the sand and said, no. We have to figure out how to become indispensable by being human, not by doing what we're told. And two books that have never been published by, quote, real publishers are Stop Stealing Dreams, which you can read for free at stopstealingdreams.com, which is a manifesto about education, which is sort of a follow-up to Linchpin, and What to Do When It's Your Turn, which I illustrated and laid out myself and self-published it, but you can find it on print on demand to this day. It is designed to get deep under your skin and cost you some sleep in the sense of highlighting just how deep the indoctrination we've been faced is and letting you know that there's a different way to do it.
Let's talk for a second about your most recent book, which is actually what prompted us to reconnect, Song of Significance. Mm-hmm. That book probably spoke to me as much as any book since Purple Cow. Talk about that for a second.
Well, I think it says a lot about you that it resonated. I think it's the kind of CEO and founder that you are. The book is about the fact that life is short. The planet is changing. We have plenty of advantages and privilege, and we tend to be wasting them. What is the point? What is the point of hiring someone, showing up at work, engaging with each other? How do we talk to each other? And I'm basically arguing, let's get real or let's not play. Let's come up with a joint decision and agreement about what it's like around here and that our job is to make a difference. That doesn't mean that we have to execute or deliver less. It means we need to do it in the spirit of human activity, not embracing the nonsense that Milton Friedman said about maximizing short-term shareholder value. That what we get is 2,000 hours a year, 800,000 hours, or however the math works out, 80,000 hours a lifetime. Who are you spending it with? Why are you spending doing it that way? Now that we've got a computer that can do mediocre copywriting and mediocre radiology and mediocre everything, why are you signing up to be mediocre? And why are you working with people who are treating you without respect and dignity? And if we could just talk about it, we might be able to sing a better song. And that's what I think books help us do, is talk about it. That's what I learned from Purple Cow. That's what I learned from permission marketing. Most people have never read those books. They've held them, they've gotten the joke, and then they've talked about it. But the purpose of most business books is not to read every single word. The purpose is to initiate and maintain a conversation.
I think Song of Significance could end up being your most influential book, or maybe it has to be second behind permission marketing. Because you get enough CEOs on board and the impact goes up 10 order of magnitude.
That's why I wrote it. I hope so.
How do you maintain your edge as a thought leader? How do you get the learnings that you get about what's on the ground today? Like, you're not running a business today. I don't know if you do consulting or it's just talking to a lot of people. Like, how do you get the zeitgeist?
So I don't do any consulting. I never have. I don't do any investing. I never have. And I don't do any coaching because I need to get bored. And it's very easy to fill your day with tasks. And I've worked hard not to do that. I think that the essence of my writing, the 9,000 blog posts, is simple. If I see something I can't explain or easily understand, I don't move forward until I can explain it or understand it. Why are there 40 people waiting to get into a Supreme store and buy a $90 t-shirt? Right? How did that happen? How did it happen that someone who's a real jerk could be a CEO and then they end up burning? Like, when you see it, can you explain it? Do you have a theory? And if I can share that theory, it helps me understand it and other people as well. And that gets you a blog post. It doesn't get you a book. I only write books if I have no choice, because I'm not a professional author. I'm just somebody who is trying to narrate things for people. But if the idea in a book cannot be handled in a dozen blog posts, then it has to be a book. And I try to avoid those whenever I possibly can.
Yeah, I think you've done a bad job of avoiding them over the years.
I know.
Let me ask you a few topical questions before we wrap up.
Okay.
What is your perspective on the marketing function? You know, the CMO is kind of the most maligned role, beleaguered role, shortest tenured role.
Yeah.
And, you know, you and I, of the length of the time we've known each other, the marketing function has gotten blown up, right? You used to either be a direct marketer or a brand marketer, and your biggest decision was which agency to hire. And now you have to be a technologist, you have to be an expert in 87 channels and cross-channel orchestration, et cetera. What's your view of the marketing function, where it's going, how it needs to relate to the CEO? How do CMOs get out of that hole?
Yeah, I have very strong feelings about this. What a surprise. There's no question in any organization about the accounting function. Everyone knows what accounting is. There's huge problems in what marketing is. And the reason that CMOs only last 18 months is when they show up, there is an implicit or explicit promise that they will fix a whole range of problems, but they do not have the power or authority to do so. And it takes a year and a half for the boss to figure that out. And then they figure the person is the problem. The person isn't the problem. The problem is you don't understand what marketing is. Marketing is what you make, how you make it, the side effects of it, the pricing of it, how it changes the people in the audience. Every single person in the organization works for marketing, because marketing is the thing that touches the market. It is not your slogan or your logo or the hype you bring to the world. That should be called promotion. And if you want to have a chief promotion officer, go for it. But the marketer needs to say, you know what? Our cars are boring, or they break down, or visiting the dealer is horrible. I'm not going to paper that over. If I can't sit with the engineers and the product designers, I'm not a marketer at this car company, because they're making marketing decisions all day long. And when a product sells itself, it's because it had marketing built in. And so I don't spend any time whatever. And if you look at my books, I've never written a word about how to be better tactically at things like SEO, better tactically at things like data analytics, because there are people who should do that, but that's not my definition of marketing. That's a different thing. And I've known some great CMOs, but they always run into resistance, because deep down, the CEO, the head of design, the head of customer service, they all think they do marketing too. And no one's in charge. And if you're going to take a job as a CMO, you got to be in charge of all of it.
So how does that work practically, right? Customer service is kind of its own discipline. Product is its own discipline.
But why? I mean, they all report to accounting. And if accounting says you're spending too much time on buying mink-lined telephones, they can't do it anymore, right? So what I'm arguing is the metrics that the marketer needs to bring to the job need to be appropriate and useful and actionable. And everyone who touches any of those metrics has to report to them. And so what I want to understand is, you just made a decision to move our call center to a place that is timing every call, breaking promises, et cetera. You just screwed up the marketing of this corporation. You have to answer to me because I'm responsible for that. And that's missing from a lot of organizations, even the legendary ones like Apple and Google, both of whom have messed up in the last 3 years dramatically on a marketing front, because, and Amazon times 10, because they're just burning trust. They're burning the benefit of the doubt. It took them decades to earn to make their stock price go up in the short run, and it will always come back to haunt them.
A colleague of mine used to talk about needing to make marketing the nose, not the tail.
I love that.
And I think so many CEOs are just focused on the orchestration of the tactics as opposed to putting it at the front of strategy.
Yeah. And the other thing about, you know, your logo is lovely, and I'm guessing that you approved it. You have no business approving your logo. That's promo. That's like trivial. It doesn't matter that all the stuff that they're sitting in committee rooms dancing the CMO around with some agency presentation, none of it matters. Just move on. We need to have substantial conversations about the game theory, the scarcity, the affiliation, the status roles, these conceptual things that I write about in This Is Marketing. That's what marketing is.
All right. Two more questions.
Okay.
Talk to me about AI. What is your outlook for business or humanity as we see AI and all of its good and bad and not ugly, but weird, show up?
Charles Babbage was talking to the king of Sardinia in 1840. And the king said to him, what good is the telegraph going to be? Why would anyone need to send a message that quickly? And 18 years later, everything was different. It only took, you know, 20 years. AI is a bigger change to our world since anything except electricity. And people don't talk about it enough. They're not using it enough. They don't understand it enough. If you're a mediocre radiologist, there is now AI that can read a wrist x-ray better, faster, cheaper than you. Changes everything. One career after another. The same way the steam shovel made ditch digging not really a career. So the transformational power is huge in ways that I can't even begin to wrap my arms around. But I know that we're not spending nearly enough time looking straight at it. We're just looking at the convenient, gimmicky stuff that it's doing right now. From a humanity point of view, no one lives forever. Everyone dies. We're all gonna die. We might die from an AI apocalypse. We might die from a flood caused by carbon. And we might die in our bed at 104 years old. I don't know. But we ought to do things in the meantime that weave together possibility, fairness, opportunity. And AI opens some of those doors. And for the people who are working to make it safer, I'm in favor. But for people who just want to pretend it doesn't exist, I don't understand that.
All right. Last question.
Okay.
Our audience is mostly CEOs, founders. The last 20 minutes have been packed with actionable advice for them. But if you had to give one piece of advice to CEOs, your best and final, what would it be?
I'm gonna use my privilege to say I have two.
You can have two. You could even have more than two.
The first one is, the day you took venture funding is the day you agreed to sell your company. So stop denying that that's the case and start planning for it. Number two, which goes with that a little bit, is you only get this project once, and you should treat people the way you'd like to be treated. The ends don't justify the means, and it's not personal. You signed up to have a business. You are part of it, and so are other people. But don't treat them like business. Treat them like people, because that's who they are. And there's only one out of every, I don't know, 20 million people on this earth who get to do what you're doing. You could do it more humanely, more kindly, more thoughtfully than you are. But we get so distracted with things that are easy to measure, we forget to focus on the things that are worth measuring.
Seth Godin, thank you so much for joining me. This was a great conversation.
Super fun. Thank you, Matt.
Good to see you.